Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Good evening, everybody. This is Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. This is show number 148, and it is March 27th, 2024. I'm your host, Tom Riedel, and co-host Terry Brown will not be with us tonight, but hopefully she'll be back with us on Monday when we have another show lined up for you. I'm your host again, Tom Riedel, and brief intro to today's show. We have on Paul Lamb. He'll be here with his book, One Match Fire. We'll be talking to Paul about 15 minutes after the hour. Now, more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net. In the blog section and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for the Writer's Lounge, or find us easily on a Google search. Our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we'll certainly get back to you. I've been doing book reviews for over 11 years now, and besides those reviews being posted on my site, I also review for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike. If you are a reader of books and are looking for a good book to read, check them out. You will not be disappointed. Upcoming authors and the Writer's Lounge on Monday, April 1st, April Fool's Day, Kevin Chapman will be here with The Other Murder, when two reporters converge on trying to piece together a story about two murders that happened on the same night and close together in distance. Secrets are revealed that could get them both killed. So tune in for that one on Monday night. And remember, that's Monday, April 1st. And April 15th, we have an Ox DeVere who wrote Rage of the Djinn, and a team of excavators restoring a site underneath the Notre Dame. They make a stunning discovery. Beneath the floor of the cathedral, an unmarked sarcophagus. So that's a very interesting lead into that, and it's a It's going to be a good read, and I can't wait to get to that, and it'll be coming up again on April 15th. That would be tax day, so everybody will remember that very well, I'm sure. And next segment of our show, which we normally do, Writer's Topics, and again, this is where I normally would introduce Terry and bring her on. We would talk about the topic of the show, and tonight, of course, she will not be here, but hopefully she'll return with us on Monday night. But I do have an announcement, and I've been working feverishly over the last couple of days and in the last couple of months, actually, to put the book together and get it out there and published. And I am happy to say that the book is about ready to be launched. And it is The Life and Times of Benjamin Murphy, a Central New York ghost story. And as I said, it's about ready to launch and putting on the final touches of that happening. And if you would like to check it out, it's not on the website yet, but it will be soon. And you can purchase it over there again at thomasrydell.net. So go over there and take a look. Anyways, just head on over there and take a look at what I got on the page. I think you'll be interested in what I have. I've written a few other books there, and you can purchase them there as well as on Amazon. They're also available there too. So anyway, getting on to the writer's topics of tonight, I did have a chat with Terry a few shows back, and we talked about a thing called flash fiction. It's something that I think a lot of writers should get more involved in, because I think it really helps. A lot of times writers need a boost to jumpstart their creative juices. And sometimes we need to take a break from the novel writing and get onto writing flash fiction. And it's a great little thing to do. And I won't talk much more about it here because I have a clip lined up and it's about 7 minutes long. And after that, we'll come back and we will talk with Mr. Paul. He'll be here with us about 15 minutes after the hour. But anyways, you had mentioned that I was interested in hearing about the writer's topic for tonight, which would be furious fiction. And I want to say that when I read that on your Facebook page, I immediately was reminded of a book that I have. It's so, I don't know, I'm holding it right now in my hands. It's about, I don't know, maybe 200 pages in length, but it's called Write the Story. And some of the topics here would be the year 2563, Haunted House, Encounter at Sea. And what it does is it gives you these stories that you have to write. You only get about one page, and I believe probably around 500 words. And some of the words that you have to use, or some of the titles of these stories, the first one would be A Strange Request at a Piano Bar. And you have to use the words carnival, apple, sprained, juvenile, mask, twirl, and awkward. And so you have to include all those words in the story, and it's quite a challenge to do that. And I found it very entertaining to write some of these stories that I've already written in this book. And very, very challenging to do this. And I'm wondering, Terry, with your furious fiction, how are you doing with that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Furious fiction is something that the Australian Writers' Center puts out. They give you 55 hours, so they put it out on a Friday, but it's Australian time, so I always have less than 55 hours because they put it out in the middle of the night for me. And then they give you usually a location or where they need the story to start, and then they give you three totally unrelated words, and you have to write a flash fiction story. Flash fiction is, for those who don't know, it's shorter than a short story. It's typically 1,000 words or less, and then different places will have flash fiction at different lengths. So for furious fiction, it has to be 500 words or less. I do one that has to be under 50 words. I do another one that has to be exactly 53 words. So it's really interesting to try to write within those very tight parameters. For instance, the Furious Fiction that just passed this past weekend it has to be less than 500 words. It had to happen in a restaurant, and it had to include the words euphoria, silhouette, and labyrinth.
Mm.
And so then you just have to start writing. Yeah, it's like what comes to mind? What, you know, what's there? And the one that I'm doing that's three, I think it's called 53 Prime, and it's 53 words exactly. This month's has to be about the search. This one's a little easier in terms of they don't give you words that you have to use, but it has to be exactly 53 words, not less than 53, exactly 53. So
wow.
That's a little harder because, you know, you get your story written and then you realize that maybe you're at 57 and then I have to figure out which four words to go. Or can you rewrite a sentence in a way that you've gotten rid of a word? Or what if you're at 51 words? Now, where are you going to add and which words are you going to pick? Because you don't want to just make any 53 words. It's trying to make the best 53 words. So, you know, is it ever going to make anyone famous or a lot of money? Probably not. But I think it's a really good tool to kind of teach yourself how to write within certain parameters and how to, you know, how to keep it brief and how to tell a story in a short amount of time and how to create a twist and all of those things. I just really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
What I like about it, too, is that it also gives you the opportunity, if you want to revisit it in the future and maybe expand on it and turn it into a full-length novel. You
exactly.
know, if the theme is there and you really like it, why not stretch it out? Why not make it into a novel? And that's why I keep going back every now and then to this book that I have, Write the Story, and I look at these short stories that I've written and wonder, you know, can I turn it into a novel? So it's there. I think
right.
the benefits
right. and
of writer,
you know,
yes.
did you create a character? You know, like is there a character there that
yes.
maybe it isn't that story, but that character keeps coming back to you? And so you think, well, what could I do with that character? Could I incorporate this piece into something because of this character? I think it's also a really good way, especially if you're feeling a little bit blocked. You
yes.
know, like you don't know what you're supposed to write. Like, I just feel kind of like I don't know where I'm going from here. To kind of have this, you know, 55 hours, you have to write 500 words. It has to be in a restaurant with these three words, go. It gives your mind a focus point. And then even if you don't come up with anything that's fantastic, you've been thinking about writing and doing some writing and flipping words around in your head, and I think it kind of helps move that blockage along so that it isn't quite so profound.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, it would be very good for writer's block, and I think all of us run into that from time to time, especially if we're engaged in a story and deep in a story. I just am coming to the end of writing a story that I've been working on for a number of years now, and it's only, I think, 30,000 words. It's not too long. But sometimes you have to disengage and you have to get out of it, get into something else. And then when you come back, sometimes what you find out is you're right back into the story again. Because it does. It really wears on your brain to stay in the story for a long period of time. It's almost like, I don't know, when I try to disengage from my writing today, I'm walking around the house thinking I'm still in the story and I've got things to do in the house.
Right.
That kind of helps you get out into these other little smaller stories and work on them. Anyways, let's get on to the next segment. Okay, hope you like that little segment. And it was a lot of fun talking about that with Terry. And I hope you all, if you're a writer, hope you all take some advice from that and take a shot at that flash fiction or furious fiction. But anyways, let's get on to the next segment. would be guest author, intro, and interview. And, of course, we have Paul M. here with One Match Fire. And I want to remind everybody out there, if you are listening to the show live, you can call us in at area code 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. And my review of One Match Fire is about a lakeside cabin in the woods where three generations of men and one family go to find peace and bonding that isn't always possible in the complexities of their lives. A grandfather, a son, and a grandson find a connection with one another there. The grandfather built it, enabling him to learn how to be a dad after his own father abandoned him, and his son becomes a father at a very young age and struggles to please his son, who is hiding a secret that he fears could destroy any hopes he has to strengthen his relationship with his father. During the course of decades, they cut wood, built campfires, went skinny dipping, cleared the land, learned the rituals like searching for ticks, learning to swim and to fish and to just be themselves in an environment that they could appreciate and love together. It was a place where love had the opportunity to grow between them. Family traditions helped that process along, but as in most relationships, self-doubt and an inadequacy in the roles as father, son, and grandson can be huge obstacles in bringing true harmony to a family lost in its own flaws and fears. How will this family survive and learn the lessons that this special place had to offer? This is the best of what a good coming-of-age story should be about. It highlights the wonders and pleasures as well as the adversities that all of us face as we move through the years. It challenges us to try and look at situations and people through a different lens and to attempt to find a way to understand and to love the people who are especially close to us, like family, a little more than we do. The author tells a nice, heartwarming story filled with happiness, sadness, and hope, all the things life is made of. I loved One Match Fire. And now it is our pleasure to welcome Paul Am to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And I will reach over here and open up the magic door to Imaginary Studios and invite Paul to come in and sit down. And Paul, are you there?
I am there, yes. Hello,
well,
Tom.
Okay. Well, that, most people don't know, but we had some technical issues. We tried to do the show a couple of nights ago and it didn't work, so I'm glad you made it through the door this time and you're here with me now. So tell us about yourself and what inspired you to become a writer.
Well, as far as I can remember, as far back as I can remember, I was writing stories. I can remember reading things to my mother when I was just a boy, and of course she told me how wonderful they were, and I'm sure she did that out of love and out of reality. But I always thought that writing was what I was suited for best. I was always a reader. I would always escape into books, and I think to be a writer, you have to be a reader. So as I was reading, I was learning how it's done, what I liked, what I didn't like, and so forth. And I just kept at it. Early in my married life, I was writing feature articles for newspapers and magazines. And they were all sweetness and light, nice things, and I was never trying to get a politician to give me a direct answer to anything. I was never aggressive enough for that. But I enjoyed doing that, and I made a little bit of money, but, you know, it was a hobby, and I was working at a corporate job in an office to pay my bills and raise my family and so forth. So it was always something I did on the side, and mostly for myself, not for recognition or income or anything like that. But all along, I knew that I wanted to write fiction, and I just felt that I needed to keep practicing the craft until I could approach fiction with enough self-control and self-respect and vision to do it justice. And so I slowly began doing that, and for a long time, I couldn't tell which genre I was going to write in. I tried some science fiction stories. I tried a few cozy mysteries, so forth and so on. But what I always seemed to come back to were character-based stories, not so much about the plot as in how the characters react to what's happening in the plot. how they make it move forward and how they respond to what happens to them. And that seems to be what I've settled on now for my writing. Most of my published short stories are about characters rather than about events or crimes or things like that. I learned shortly before this call that I've just had another story accepted this afternoon at a magazine. So I was pleased about that. And what happened was I happened to have a cabin in the Missouri Ozarks, just as the characters in this novel do, One Match Fire. And I thought, well, if I have this nice place that I love so much, why don't I try to write something about it? So I wrote a story it became the prologue of One Match Fire, and it was about a man who has to sell the family cabin to pay his father's medical bills, which are just crippling them otherwise. And it's heart-wrenching for him to give up what his father had made, and he has a lot of self-doubt because he couldn't keep things going and so forth. And the point of it to me was to give my children a sort of template on what the cabin means to me and what they might do with it when my time was over. And so I wrote that story and I liked it, and it got published in a magazine and I was pleased with it. But then the character came back and said, you know, as long as we're talking about this, why don't you tell this story about me too? So I wrote another story about him, and then another and another, and I had probably half a dozen stories, and I was getting them published, and I was pleased about that. And I showed them to a writer friend of mine, and I said, what do you think about this? Do you think I have a story collection here? Is it something that all of it's tied together through through the cabin? And he says, no, you don't. You have a novel here, and the sooner you look at it that way, the sooner it's all going to come together. Well, that opened the floodgates. Once I understood that, I was able to look at it as a whole rather than as parts. And what I saw was that, oh, well, there's a gap here. You know, I don't have anything about middle school when this boy's in middle school. And, what about high school? And now he has a son of his own, and what's going on? And so I found the gaps, and I filled those in with other stories. I edited them so they would flow together a little better, because they had been just standalone stories on their own. And then I had a whole novel, and I was very pleased with what it came together as. And so I started shopping it around. I tried to get some agents, but no one would bite. And I tried a bunch of publishers, and no one would bite. And I thought about serializing it on Substack, which is an online site that's kind of like for newsletters and all, but a lot of people put their novels on there, and I thought I could do that. But then the week that I retired from working for a living, when I said, now my time's my own, that very first week, I found this publisher that wanted to publish things from the Midwest. And so I sent it to them saying, what do I have to lose? And 5 months later, they approached me and they said, is this still available? Because we'd like to publish it. And I calmed myself down before I responded, because, you know, I was about doing cartwheels down the street. I said, oh, yeah, it does happen to still be available. And so then the whirlwind came, and it was published within 2 months of acceptance, which is
great.
Outrageously swift for the publishing.
That's great, Paul. It's really great to hear. Sometimes we get discouraged as writers, and we kind of put things aside, and sometimes things just heat up. And, you know, it's kind of segueing into your story. It's sort of like a fire that builds and starts up, and then all of a sudden you're off to the races and everything. It looks great as far as publishing. But you tell a very deep story about the emotions of three generations of men, the grandfather, the son, and the grandson. What do you want readers to specifically take away from your story in that regard?
I think what sort of theme I think I would suggest is that despite differences, despite people being different people who we can never fully know, we can still come together, we can still love each other, and we just have to find a way to do that. In this novel, it was always the cabin that took them outside of their other world, where all their problems and frustrations were. They could go to the cabin together, and they were separated from everything, and they could drop their defenses and just be at peace with each other. And it's no coincidence that they do a lot of skinny dipping at their cabin, because they're literally dropping defenses when they do that. They're fully accepting each other and not feeling any, because they know they're safe with each other at this place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say that's the theme, that, you know, you have to find whatever the common ground is to find where the love is waiting for you.
I know we talked a little bit before about character development. You just alluded to it there when you were talking about the characters that you develop. But when you're developing these characters, is it a difficult or easy process of creating a character? And how does that work in your everyday life? What happens?
Well, I'd say it is certainly, if you're going to do it right, it's certainly a difficult process. You have to know this person as well as you know yourself and your characters. And I had the luxury of taking 10 years to do this. The first story that I wrote more than a decade ago. And so they came to me slowly over those years. So I got to know the character, and I understood, well, in this situation, how would he react? Well, this one's the grandson, he's very organized with his thoughts. So he would think this way. And the grandfather kind of wings it because, you know, he doesn't really know what fathering's about. He didn't have a father. So he tries this, he tries that. Something works, something doesn't, and he's just going to keep going. And then the middle son, the middle character, is full of self-doubt. I made him that way partly because he became a father so early. And he thought he had ruined his life by doing that. And so he's crippled by this self-doubt. And that affects how he reacts and behaves and thinks. And so that was part of the character development, was just putting them in situations and understanding how they would behave.
Right. Now, and I'm sure
I think the middle character is the kind of person I would like to be if I could improve myself enough. So that was more an aspirational character. The other two, you know, they're kind of reflecting the middle character.
Right, right. One thing I really enjoyed, and I think we all enjoy when we're going up to a campsite, is sitting around a fire and watching the flames spark up and just sitting there and getting kind of lost in our thoughts and not really paying attention to the complexities of the relationship. We're just sort of relaxed and we don't always talk about the problems. In those settings, we usually just kind of think about just the environment that we're in and enjoying each other's company. But one thing that I really found very fascinating was, and it relates back to the title of your book, is when you talk about what it takes to start a one-match fire, trying to figure out in the title what exactly that meant. And it took me a while to get into the story to realize what that was and how did this evolve into becoming the main theme of the story. And explain the one-match fire, if you could.
Well, I suspect it goes back to my days in the Boy Scouts when that was a challenge that we all had. And I think the Boy Scouts allowed us to light a fire with two matches, but I made it one for mine. And what it is in the story is a sort of a ritual that the father hands down to the son. It's a skill that he teaches his son, and it's one thing that unites them. And so even though the middle character and his son are often at odds with each other, the son knows that he can do this one thing better than his dad can. And so his dad's going to still be impressed and pleased with him. So it is a sort of a ritual in the family, and it's handed down from father to son.
And it has to do with the kindling and the branches and yes. Having the right weather condition. The wind can't be blowing too hard. You have to kind of wait and be a little bit patient. And I know because I've tried it, and I'm not real good at building a fire, but I know how challenging it can be. And if you've ever watched these, what came to my mind when I was reading your story is these television shows on TV when you have Survivor, and they have to do that as part of their ritual to stay in the game, is to start a fire. And I believe in one episode of Survivor, they did exactly have that. But you didn't have a match. You had a rock, you had a stone, you had flint, and all of that stuff. So you had to do it the old-fashioned way to get a fire going. And there's a process involved in doing all that, which really fascinated me. And it fascinated me in your story and how you brought that together too. It's those little things that you put into a story, I think, that really captures the reader. And I think in my case, that was one of the things that captured me to your story, was when you were explaining about the one match fire.
Well, and to do it, you have to slow down. You have to be careful and think through what it is you're doing. And so that takes you out of your worries and your frustrations and all the little squabbles you have with other people. You have to really focus on this thing, and that helps release you from everything else.
Yes, and also chopping down trees, as it happened in your story too. Yeah, you had to know where the tree is going to fall and where to stand and where not to stand.
Is the tree hollow or is it not? And are there too many branches on this side? Which way is it going to lean? And all of that, It's woodcraft. And it's, once again, one more thing to hand down from father to son.
Yeah, very, very good. How important is the narrative and dialogue in the story, and which one do you like to write the most?
I think I have a lot of fun with the dialogue, putting words in characters' mouths and trying to keep them in tone with the characters. One, the middle character is not well educated. I call him one of life's C students. He's going to work hard. He's going to do okay, but he's never really going to excel at anything. So I give him the kind of vocabulary of that kind of a man. But his son, the grandson character, he goes on to become a doctor. So he's very articulate, very careful with his words, and he'll throw in all sorts of medical terms, sometimes because that's his vernacular, and sometimes just to baffle his father and show him, I'm a little smarter than you, Dad, so there. Mm-hmm. So, but, you can have fun with them being witty with each other, bantering back and forth, that kind of thing. Narrative is where I think the hard work is done. And part of the way I control that is to give myself a narrator who I know as well as I know any character. Essentially, the narrator is not me. It is another character of the story, the person telling the story. So I know who he is, what he looks like, what his concerns are, what his ambitions are about the story and that kind of thing. In One Match Fire, it's hinted, but I never say it outright, that the Kelly character who appears at the end is the narrator.
Oh.
And he is, he arrives pretty late in the story, and he's narrated an idealized version of these people. He admires the family. He wants to be part of it. And so he's telling the story about them in what he thinks is golden terms. And that's why I wrote those 300-word first-person vignettes between each chapter where the characters could get up and speak their own points just for themselves, because they pretty much told me that Kelly's narration was too idealized, and, we're people with flaws, and let us speak for ourselves. So that's where that comes in.
Oh.
So it's a third-person narrator and then first-person snuck in between each chapter.
It's interesting. I'm not sure I caught up with the Kelly character and as the narrator there, but that's interesting. It's sometimes a challenge in what POV to use when you're writing a story.
Right.
You have to sit down and really think about it. And sometimes I get tied up with this present tense or past tense. When I'm writing it, is it happened before or is it happening now? And
right,
so
right.
That's sometimes where I get caught up when I'm writing the story that I'm writing. But anyways, you were just speaking about communication between members of a family, which you've got three generations there that are in constant communication. I just was wondering, do you think we're better as a society in focusing on family today, or do you think we were better at it in, say, 50 years ago?
Well, I mean, I'm not a sociologist.
It kind of ties into social media. Are we supposed to be a lot more communicative today through the use of social media, in-person communication? But just wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, let's see. When we moved to the house I'm in now, that was 30-something years ago, we were the first family on the block to have a computer. That was a long time ago, and computers were novelties. But we were the first family, and neighbors would come over to use it to write their Christmas letters or whatever. But our thought at the time was, this has to be part of our children's lives. It has to be just the same as receiving a newspaper on Sunday morning or whatever. So that was our attitude then. Now, my grandchildren, the ones who are old enough, all have tablets. My 4-year-old granddaughter calls me regularly on her tablet to FaceTime with me. I'd say that we have a means for being more communicative as families than the previous generation. You know, 3 or 4 generations ago, somebody left the old world, went to the new world and seek their fortunes, and they never heard from that person again. And that was the norm. Now, you know, my 4-year-old granddaughter can call me from Seattle all the way to Kansas City and just chat with me and catch up. And that's kind of, so I'd say that it's a mixed blessing. There's a lot of nonsense, a lot of threat on the internet, but
yep,
there's a lot of potential to it too, especially for communication.
Yeah, that's the way I kind of look at it too. It's sort of a mixed bag. It's sort of, as I tell everybody, when the telephone came, everybody was on it and gossiping about the neighbors, and then you had the party
right.
lines involved, and then
right.
you get the kids that want their own phone, and then they either get their own phone or they don't. And if they don't get their own phone, they're always on the parents' phone, and the parents have to complain. You know, it happened to me when I was younger, and I would communicate a lot with, the girls, of course, came into the picture, and I would be on the phone for hours and hours and hours. But I think, again, as it relates back to your story, as you're talking about, you know, a son talking to the father and the grandson talking to the the grandfather and all that stuff, it's it just interests me to the point where I would have to say that I think today we're not as communicative as we were back then, in a sense that we're not as, I don't know, it's hard to say. We're not as wise as we once were in how we communicated. Now there just seems to be an overload of stuff that we don't really sit down and talk about the stuff that's really important. And that's mm-hmm. what I would say needs to be done. And in your story, you had mentioned about, the characters' concern. I won't bring up some of the concerns of your characters because I don't want to spoil the story for the readers out there.
Okay.
But I think it's important that that you sit down and talk to people. I mean, really talk to people.
Yes.
And being around a campfire, being at camp, gives you the opportunity to do that. And I just don't think today there's a lot of those opportunities. We don't have those opportunities like we used to have.
Yeah, I think with social media, we can communicate spontaneously, which means we might not be communicating deeply. We can say whatever's in our mind at that moment. Whereas if you take the time to write a letter by hand to someone, you're going to think your thoughts through more slowly and more carefully. So I think you're right about that, there's a quality that's lost when there's an increase in opportunity.
Right. Do you do a lot of reading, and who are your favorite authors?
Well, I do a lot of reading. Of course you have to. My favorite authors, you know, that changes all the time, but I've read every word of fiction that Philip Roth ever wrote. He is in complete control of his writing. And when you read it, you get the idea that even the punctuation marks are exactly the right thing.
Uh-huh.
I read him more for the craft rather than the subject matter. Some of his stuff is a little off color and raunchy and misogynistic sometimes. But he certainly knows how to use words. I read the British writer Iris Murdoch. She was a philosopher as well as a writer. And she creates these wonderful characters and puts them in really strange situations. I'm reading one right now that's her version of Shakespeare's play The Tempest. So that's really kind of wild. I will pick at other writers. People recommend that I try this book and that. Usually that doesn't pay out for me. I've read Moby Dick 4 times, and I feel like I've just started to understand that novel. Things like that. I think I've read Frankenstein 3 or 4 times as well, and it's the same thing. There's so much there.
Oh, yes.
And
Treasure Island would be another one, was a favorite of mine growing up.
And it's where you started. It's your embarking point.
Yes.
But I will try to read just about everything.
I want to remind everybody once again, if you're thinking about giving us a call here, somebody came on and then they left. They must have gotten scared, Paul. I don't know why they got scared, but... they came on and then they left. But once again, if you want to call us, area code 914-219-0868. We've got about 15 minutes left here of our interview with Paul. And the next question I have for you, sir, is where do you go to write, and how many hours or words do you average in a day?
I write in what used to be my daughter's bedroom. She's grown up and has babies of her own now. So it's in my house. It's on the second floor. I close the door. I generally will play brown noise, which is like white noise, to muffle all of the other sounds that come around so that I can just focus on my writing. I work on a laptop, a MacBook Air, and, generally, I will rise at a ridiculous hour. Usually, it's 3:30 in the morning because the house is quiet. Yeah. Well, there was a time when I had 4 teenagers in my house. And if I wanted a hot shower, I had to be the first one in the morning to get a shower. So I learned to get up early that way. And so now, you know, it's wonderful. It's my private time. It's my time. And that's emphasized because the world is asleep and I'm up doing my thing. So I'll sit and I'll start writing. And generally what I'll do is reread what I wrote the day before, or at least parts of it, to pick up the tone or the rhythm or whatever it was that was working for me then. And then I'll just throw myself into the next sentences, the next chapters, whatever is coming next.
Yep.
I don't assign myself a word count. I don't think that's healthy, because then I think I might be forcing myself to produce words that aren't good, or I might be disappointed in myself if I can't do that. So I will write until I feel like I've exhausted my creativity for that session. Some days I'm happy with a couple hundred words. One day I calculated, this astonished me when I found out, I wrote 12,000 words in one day.
Wow.
And I never, ever want to do that again. That was insane. Now, there
That's
were probably
incredible.
All crappy words, you know, just not good. But that was work. And
yeah,
and you know, you're in the zone. You're in that place. You're in that flow state, I think they call it. And so keep going.
Right.
And know that writing is rewriting. You know, everything you write, you're going to have to rewrite. And then
yes.
an editor will get a hold of it, and bam, that'll be some more changes. So, but it's an organic process for me. I don't assign myself anything. There might be a change. I might go to bed the night before and say, tomorrow morning I'm going to work on chapter 7. And that's an assignment to me, but that also seems to work. That, you know, chapter 7 seems to come together then because I prepared myself. Other times I said, I got to go back and fix that plot problem. And then the next morning I get up and I can do it. But
yes.
otherwise it's just, I just sit down and what's going to happen today? And
yes.
keep my fingers running.
A lot of writers have mentioned those same words to me, is that just a matter of, like you said, doing the flow thing, just let the words go, and then you're going to have to go back and edit. And speaking of editing, how has editing, publishing, and marketing gone for you? Any advice?
Don't be in love with your words. Don't be too much in love with them. My editors crawled all over my manuscript. And we did this all online, so it was in Word, and it was redlined and back and forth. We did a bunch of Zoom calls to go through this chapter and then the next chapter. And I think, you know, of course, they improved it. They saw things that I didn't get. This wording is clumsy. Well, it made sense to me because I wrote it. But when they said that, it was clear that, oh, yeah, a reader's not going to get what I'm going for there and all of that. So the editing was... as it should be. It was rigorous, but it improved the text. I really think so, and I'm pleased with that. And then the publishing, well, they took on most of that. Now, this is traditionally published, so it's conventional publisher, and I...
You can give a plug to them if you'd like.
Well, it's Blue Cedar Press. They're out of Wichita, Kansas, and they're taking really good care of me. In fact, they're publishing the sequel to One Match Fire. It'll be coming out in June, and we did the same thing with that. Yeah.
Great.
What I've found, what surprised me, the hard part of all of this is the author part of being a writer, which is now that you're published, you have to promote this thing. You have to get this thing some profile. And, you know, I know that it's not going to make me rich and famous. But I do want this novel to have a life, to appear in libraries and be discussed at book clubs and that kind of thing, and to be known at least at some level. So I'm on the hustle all the time, finding podcasts to talk to, book review sites that'll give it a review, trying to get it into the libraries, trying to get it into newspapers, and it's a constant hustle. And I, you know, like most writers, I'm not a self-promoter. I'm not comfortable with that at all. And yet I have to do this. So here I am. And
I
you know, once you get started on this, you build a momentum.
I think the consensus is with most authors, especially the ones that have been on the Writer's Lounge, is that marketing is the toughest part, but it also takes away from what you're in love with doing, and that is the writing. So it's like the thing that we hate the most is taking up the most time, and it is difficult. And to hand it off to somebody else doesn't usually work that way. You really have to
Not
go
anymore.
Out there and promote it yourself.
You do. You do. It's just like writing is rewriting. Well, being an author is hustling. It is the new world order, and we just have to accept that and align ourselves to it.
Yeah, unless you're somebody like Stephen King and you don't have to do any marketing. You just put your name on the cover and off you go.
Right, right. That's so rare.
So take us all the way back, Paul, and tell us what it was like when you first held your first published book in your hands.
I wish I could give you a wonderful story about that, but I can't. I didn't receive my author copies. The publisher gave me 20 copies of my own, and I didn't receive those as quickly as I'd hoped. But somebody who did receive a copy was my wife. She ordered it online and had it shipped to our house. So my novel was in my house and in her hands a couple of weeks before I had my big reveal, my box opening reveal. So it was kind of a second act, sort of a letdown a little when my books finally arrived and I could. But still, there is an intangible but inescapable feeling of pride in holding your novel in your hands and seeing it in reality and seeing it tangible, paper copy, not just an ebook.
Right. Yeah. And so tell us, what did your wife think about your book?
Well, of course, she's my greatest supporter. She read the manuscript. She read all the stories when they were just stories, and then she read the manuscript. And she'll say something offhand like, oh, you know, what happened with that tree that they cut down? And suddenly I'm back upstairs in my writing room, 2 hours of work, you know, addressing whatever casual thing she thought of.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I am grateful for that. That you know, she will see things that I don't, and she understands me, so she understands what my motivations are. But yeah, it's great to have that kind of a reader.
It's good to have somebody like that. And unfortunately, in the last couple of years, I no longer have somebody next to me in my house, but it used to be my wife when she was living, and she would do edits and she would read over the chapters and tell me what I was doing right and what I was doing wrong, because she was a writer herself. So it's great when you can have somebody like that. And sometimes I have to admit, I don't take criticism too well. It's very hard for me to put my baby out there and have somebody criticize the baby. And I even told that to my recent publisher, the one that's putting out the book that's coming out here in a couple of weeks. I told him that. He asked me if I have any problem with criticism. I go, yes, I do. But that doesn't mean I don't want you to criticize me. I certainly want you to criticize me. I don't care what I tell you in return. You need to criticize me because I need to hear it. So that's kind of like, I think that's healthy. I think instead of just closing off everything and just going, you know, your own way and throwing everybody else under the bus. But anyway, Paul, this is sort of your Oscar moment here on the Writer's Lounge. Any parting words about One Match Fire? And is there anyone you would like to thank for the successes you've had with the book and in life?
Well, you know, you don't accomplish anything great without the help of a whole lot of other people. And as I said, my wife probably gets the most credit for it. My editors at Blue Cedar Press, who molded it into something greater than it was. I have a couple of friends who read things for me, and they always make insightful contributions to it. There was a teacher I had in high school who read something I wrote, some essay for English class, and he said, he pulled me aside after class, and he said, look, you should consider being a writer professionally. You have what it takes to do this. And that was one of the most formative moments of my life when he said that. And later I don't know. That was back in my St. Louis life, and I haven't been there in 40 years. I don't know. And there was a second teacher who read something I wrote, and he said something similar, that this is a sign of an artistic mind. And, you know, that was what all I needed to hear then, was I can do this thing. And of course it took practice and such, and I can be grateful to my wife and my children for letting me have the time to do that. But yeah, you can't do this in a vacuum. Nobody does. And there are a lot of people to thank.
And so what's your one line of advice that you would give to a writer if they were to come to you and say, I want to do a book, I want to write a book, what do you suggest that I do?
One line of advice, probably never give up. I'd say
that's
just keep persevering. Yeah, if you have the vision, you just keep sticking with it.
Mm-hmm. I would say that that works for me. It's been my advice to myself many times. So anyway, where can listeners contact you? I know that, you know, just through a Google search, but where specifically can they go to get a hold of you and your book? And your next book that's coming out, I shouldn't mind.
Yes.
Have you got a title for that next book?
Yes, that's called Parent Imperfect. And once again, it's about fathers and sons. And it's actually the characters from One Match Fire in the subsequent years. And I introduce a couple more characters. So it's Parent Imperfect. It'll come out in June. I can be found online at paullamwriter.com. And that has links to my blog and to all of my published short stories that are online to be read and events that are happening in my writer life and so forth. The book itself, anyone can order it online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Bookshop. Any bookstore in the country can order it, so people can get it that way. And if you want to be really nice to me, you go to Blue Cedar Press and order it through them, and I get a few extra nickels that way.
Very good. Paul, it's been great having you on. I'm glad we were able to get this show in after the technical difficulties, and I wish you nothing but success in the future, and hopefully you'll listen to the show and promote this show. This is your show. Use it. It's a good tool to have, and much success in the future, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's been great on here.
And have a good night.
All right. You too. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. So there goes Paul Lam, and he wrote once again One Match Fire. It was a good interview, and sorry that Terry wasn't here, but she will be here on Monday. I usually say 2 weeks, but because of the technical difficulties, we're just a few days away from the next show. And we have on Kevin Chapman, who wrote The Other Murder, When Two Reporters Converge on Trying to Piece Together a Story about Two Murders That Happen on the Same Night and Close Together in Distance. Secrets are revealed that could get them both killed. So until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot.